Violence. These groups are everywhere in Egypt.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
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 Here I am. With Shai Davidi.
Unlike many other episodes, we took our time. So today we will be releasing the first part of a two-part episode, but I urge you to listen to all of it and to the next part that will be released next week. Before we begin, I would like to thank our supporters on Patreon, and if you're not yet supporting our podcast, we would very much appreciate your support. Any small or large amount matters, goes a long way to support our podcast. Go to patreon.com/shaidavidai. My guest today is a very, very special person. She's an Egyptian writer, civil rights activist, outspoken critic of Hamas and the Western world in many ways. I am in awe of her, and I hope that by the end of this conversation, I'm sure you will be too. Here I am with Dalia Ziada.
Thank you so much. I am really honored and excited to be here with you today. You're also one of the heroes who's been fighting your own fight as well. So I'm really glad I'm with you today.
I think we're in a way we're all fighting the same fight from different angles. And which brings me to really the first question that I want to ask you. I don't think I know the answer. And I think I have some idea, but Dalia, what are you fighting for?
I'm fighting for the end of terrorism, a better Middle East, a calmer Middle East where everyone is living with everyone happily. And I'm fighting also for justice for the people who were brutalized in their homes, in their pajamas on October 7th. Actually, you know, it was at the beginning, it was for me just, okay, I believe in peace, I fight for peace. I've been working on Jewish-Muslim dialogue my whole life, on, you know, Arab-Israeli dialogue and all of this stuff. But after October 7, after watching the videos, after watching what happened to the people, and then going out to the streets in Egypt and looking at other Arab countries and seeing that my own people, my fellow Egyptians and fellow Muslims and Arabs were celebrating this just because the people killed are the Jewish people, are Jewish, you know. So I had to stand up. I had to speak up. I had to tell my people that this is not acceptable. This is wrong. So since then, it has become my fight, my own fight too. It has become personal because these people who are now these same brutal people, terrorists and their sympathizers in our region who are now going after the Jewish people. Actually, it's only one step on the way. After the Jewish people, they will go after the Christian people. And after the Christian people, they will go after women. And after women, they will go after, you know, other sects. And so it's they hate everyone. And it's what happened on October 7 was just the alarm that we have all to wake up and get rid of these people. And this ideology.
Yeah, and you, by speaking up, have paid a big, hefty price, still are, and I want to get to that. But before that, I want people to really get to know you. Who are you? Where did you come from? So what would you say is the three, four most important things people need to know about you? You were born in Egypt.
Yes. So I will actually say this three or four important stations in my life that made me who I am. Because I know for many audience, they may think, okay, a person who's an Egyptian, a Muslim, who grew up in a quite conservative society that, again, hates everyone for many reasons, it's difficult to be somehow, you know, working for peace or being open-minded and so. But to be honest, actually, I was just like everyone else at the beginning of my life. I grew up in a society that has been telling me all the time that Israel is our historical enemy. In my school, I'm educated that in primary school, and it's still there until today, actually, there is a unit about in the Arabic textbooks about the Yom Kippur War. And actually, after we study this text in our box, they take us to a museum in Cairo about the Yom Kippur War.
And which they call the October 6th War, right?
The October 6th War, exactly. Yeah. And all the time, the media, the school, the mosque is telling us that the Jewish people are our enemies and Israel is our enemy. So I grew up believing that this is the truth until something, this is like the very first station I will speak about. Something amazing happened when I was in my first year as a freshman student, or a fresh woman, as I like to call it, in my undergraduate university in Cairo. It was that around the time of the second intifada, the year 2000. And at that time, I was just like all the other students joining the protests that were happening on my campus against Israel. It was very trendy at that time.
You know, for you, a lot of things seem normal. I think for myself, for many of the listeners, you'd need to spell it out a bit more. So the Second Intifada was the violent uprising that targeted mostly civilian population in Israel.
Suicide bombings
and et cetera. Why were there protests in Egypt, in University of Cairo? Because
of Al Jazeera TV. Al Jazeera TV was pretty new at that time, and they were showering us with footage from Gaza and portraying the same. It's exactly similar to what's happening today. And the same story about, you know, the people are dying and the Israelis are eating, you know, the Palestinian children on breakfast, you know, like things. Yeah, the same stories, exactly the same stories that we're seeing today, except that Al Jazeera was very new at that time and very credible because it was the only station reporting from inside Gaza. So everyone took it for granted. And considered it the most credible one, including Western media, by the way. They were reporting after them. So
you were in university, so you're hearing, everyone is seeing the reporting.
Yeah, and also it was, so out of sympathy to the humanitarian situations that I'm seeing on the screen, and also it was trendy, you know, to go around the campus putting on a kufiya, you know, and so I just joined. I was 18 years old. I joined, and after about like 2 months, participating in these protests, the people organizing the protest decided to make a show by burning some flags. So they started by burning the Israeli flag and then the American flag, which I couldn't understand at that time why they are doing that, but okay. And then they burned the Egyptian flag. And this was the moment, was literally the moment I got out of the ideological box I was stuck into my whole life before that. My
Why?
Whole 18 years. Because it's we have very strong nationalist sentiments in Egypt. We are raised all the time that the flag must be respected. This nation state that's called Egypt must be respected. Now these people who are claiming that they are standing up for a noble cause, they are burning my flag. And then when I investigated further, I learned that these people are the Muslim Brotherhood. The people organizing the protests on my campus, or who were organizing the protests on my campus at that time, were the Muslim Brotherhood.
So before we get to that, because I want people to understand everything there, who did you think was organizing before?
Just spontaneous activists who came spontaneously to get, just activists, you know, people came spontaneously, students. We did not really realize with our, you know, very primitive minds at that time, or naive minds, I would say.
You're 18-year-old.
Yeah, and like all the other students, we did not think that there is something behind it. There is someone organizing these things. It's just spontaneous thing, you know. But unfortunately, this was the case, and I took a step back, and I said something's wrong here. You know, there's something wrong. I took a step back, and I decided to educate myself about everything, to educate myself about Israel, about even Islam once again, about Judaism, and I fell in love with Judaism. It's a great, great religion, especially its emphasis on the current life and making this world a better place, not waiting for an afterlife like in Islam or so. And of course, the geopolitics of the Middle East, which later became my passion and my work. even. Mm. So now I'm a geopolitical analyst on the Middle East, you know. So this was the start. This was the beginning when I decided to be so.
So that was the first stage
exactly.
or station.
Exactly.
What was the next station?
Then I kept on working on Muslim-Jewish dialogue, Arab-Israeli dialogue. And so after I graduated and I joined even an organization here in the U.S. That was working on that. And then the next station was in 2011 with the Arab Spring. I was one of the leaders of the Arab Spring revolution in Egypt that brought down Mubarak, the Mubarak regime. We very much believed that we can make Egypt a democratic state. We really believed so. We believed that we can make change happen, but unfortunately we brought down the dictator and didn't know what to do next. Like,
wait,
you know,
so
we got stuck here.
We'll get to that. Yeah. And which is, by the way, incredible on it of its own. Like, you're not responsible for what happened next, you know.
Yeah.
But to explain to people a little bit, you know, people know about Arab Spring, and people forget that this was almost 17 years ago.
That's right.
Sorry, 14 years ago.
Yeah.
14
yeah.
years ago. And a lot of these college students were babies. They were kids. They don't know what it was. So what was Egypt before the Arab Spring? Who was Mubarak? And what was your role? What was Arab Spring?
Yeah. So what happened is that not only Egypt, but the whole region were either monarchies or dictatorships. And dictatorships mainly in the countries that turned into republicans after the communist regimes took over the region, like Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt, al-Assad family in Syria, and so on. And also al-Ba'ath regime in Iraq. And I mean, when this movement of the communists took over the region, they established dictatorships. What happened is that over the years, especially with this great invention called the internet medium, came into our lives as, you know, young people in like teenagers, you know, in 2000s and late 90s. And so all of a sudden our understanding of the world changed. We understood that there is something called democracy. There is something called democratic regimes where women has rights. You know, this was not something we can even think about in our countries, you know, where people can choose who represents them in politics. And where presidents change, which was not happening in our countries or our region. So this created a wave of young people. Mainly the millennials, you know, this generation grew up dreaming of building this democracy in their countries, in their region, in the Arab world. And thus we started to build civil society organizations, political movements, mostly liberal, actually, not leftist at all, but mostly liberal, as a response to the left, as a response to the communist regimes that existed.
I will stop you again here because I think you're so brilliant and you say so many things that I think a lot of the audience may not understand. Coming from the same area in the world, I understand. But when you say mostly liberal, not left, a lot of Americans say, what do you mean? Liberal is left, left is liberal.
Right. No. Today, actually, they are mixing both. But no, it's not like this. The left are more the socialists, the Marxists, the communists. These are not liberal. These people have, I mean, this side of people, actually, they are more radical than we think. This type of left is more radical than we think. What I'm speaking about is the classic liberalism. The good liberals, if we can call them so, the good liberals, the real liberals who believe in rights and freedoms for all without discrimination, who does not use their platforms to project hate against other groups under the claim that they are defending their own group, who don't adopt violence as a way. Actually, the whole Arab Spring, the whole revolutions that happened in Arab Spring all started as nonviolent movements. And we were trained and training our colleagues, our other activists, and I did this myself, on how to use nonviolent action and strategies in making their goals happen and never use violence. Never use violence and avoid it at all costs. Unfortunately, this is not the case for the left. The left adopts violence as part of its ideology. So it's a big difference. So this is, and also, I mean, the liberal I'm speaking about is the liberal that values Western value, that appreciates Western values of democratization and human rights, not the communist values that that actually brought the wallet backwards. So this is what we were fighting against. Our movements actually were very successful, although they were youth movements, very limited with funding and outreach and so. But thanks to the internet again, we used Facebook and Twitter in particular, and we were able to reach out to people we couldn't imagine we can ever reach out to, mobilized a lot of support. And then when the right moment came, like the explosion happened.
And were you surprised?
Kind of expected it, but surprised at the same time, of course. I mean, surprised of its size, the type of people who participated, because I remember very well, actually around like the fourth day or the fifth day in the revolution, when the revolution started, it was not a revolution. It's just people going out and protesting in the street.
That's how many revolutions start.
Yeah, against the police. Just there is a protest against the police that took longer than it should, actually. Mm. Rather than one day, it's now taking 4 days. By the fourth day, I started to see around us in the streets and in the square people who are older in age and who come from different backgrounds, like different social classes and the middle class youth. Who are usually participating in these protests. People also are very diverse, Christians, Muslims, and people who are coming even from other places like Upper Egypt, the Delta, like, you know, farmers. And so when I started to see these people in the square, I knew it's happening. I knew it was going to happen. It's now a revolution. It's now people's movement. It's not a youth movement. It's the Egyptians coming to the square to say no to this regime, to say enough to dictatorship.
Once the movement got big, very big, how did you make sure that it still remained nonviolent? Because I think one of the things that are happening in the US, people are saying, oh, I'm nonviolent, I am protesting for peace, while the person next to them is holding, you know, as a Hamas head banner and is calling for violence and destruction of Israel. And people say, well, I'm not responsible. I am just a good person from upstate New York and I just care about democracy.
Yeah.
Well, so how did you make sure?
Actually, the majority of the people who organize and participate in peaceful protests or nonviolent protests all over the world are this type of people, like middle class youth who are educated, nonviolent. They are, you know, but then, of course, other groups want to hijack your success. In our case, it was the Muslim Brotherhood again, who came to the square when we started as a liberal movement, started to succeed. And so they came to the square with their violence, with their small militia. You know, they have a hidden militia already. They came and they started to intervene and even hijack the success of the revolution, claiming that they made it. And actually, I remember in the first few days of the upheaval, we were pushing them away. We didn't want to speak with them, especially that their leaders were against us from the beginning, against this idea of going out and protesting against the regime from the start, because they had their own deals with the regime, with the dictator regime of Mubarak. And then something happened on 28th of... Oh my God, I forgot the date. As you said, it has been a very long time ago. But actually, there was a very specific momentum in the revolution, in the revolution days, when the regime sent us camels and horses from the pyramids area that were used for tourists to walk on us, because the police failed to control us, to control the protesters. They are just growing bigger. So the violence that the police used against the protesters did not lead to anything. And there were a very high discipline to nonviolence among the protesters, not because they are superheroes, you know, I mean, because they were trained. We were trained on that. We were ready that, okay, this will happen and we have to react in this way by practicing very high discipline to nonviolence.
And I think also people were aware that police violence is never okay and never fun. Obviously, prison is never fun, but under a dictatorial Mubarak's regime, it was even...
It was horrible, and yeah. people got to the point that they don't have anything to lose. Mm. So why not? Why don't I participate in this? Anyway, you know, because in all cases, this police tortures me, this police, you know, mistreats me, so I'll go and I protest. See. You know, they have nothing to lose. So at this moment, actually, we were not organized on how to deal with this thing, like camels and horses and people very violent, like Bedouins, you know, very aggressive, and they want to beat us. And so the Muslim Brotherhood youth did something. They are very well trained on how to deal with these situations, you know. They made a U-shape around us and protected the other protesters, and they dealt with the camels and horses and these people. Only at this moment, the protesters at Tahrir Square started to accept the youth of the Muslim Brotherhood as part of the movement, because they saved our lives, kind of. So we started to accept them, but we continued to reject their leaders, you know. But we accepted these youth who were with us in the square, and they saved our lives.
Why the rejection? Where is the opposition from both? You're both against Mubarak. You're, yes. you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. But why did you not get along with the Muslim Brotherhood youth?
Their ideology is horrible. First of all, discrimination against women, while most of the people participating in the protests are young women. Discrimination against non-Muslims, like the Coptic Christian people in Egypt. And they are very vocal about it. They don't even hide it. And their evil ideology that does not believe in this concept of nation state at all. Their goal is to establish some kind of a caliphate system where they rule over everyone else. And in the process, all the nation states we are seeing today are just to be destroyed, to be damaged, and they are useless. Actually, their leaders said it very clearly. One of their leaders in Egypt, in Cairo, was making a TV interview, and he said, you know, with Al Jazeera, if I remember well, and he said, you know, homeland, there is nothing called homeland. Homeland is only a bunch of dust. So there is nothing called homeland. So this is how they think. Mm. So, of course, I mean, this is what we were standing for. I mean...
So it's almost like going back to the pan-Arabism of Gamal el-Nasser.
Pan-Islamism, I would say.
Oh, interesting. So yeah. For people that don't know, there was a moment in time where Egypt and Syria became together as one pan-Arabic country. They were trying to get Jordan to join, and even Iraq wanted to join. That's why the flags are so similar.
Yes.
But you're saying this is beyond pan-Arabism. This was pan-Islamism.
Yeah, because at that time, in 2011, we were also at the pan-Islamism era. The pan-Arabism has died, and we became now in the pan-Islamism era. Okay, let me explain this to you very briefly. So what happened, especially when it comes to the relationship between Arabs and Israel, and why Arabs are so obsessed with the so-called Palestinian cause? And I say so-called because it means different things to different people. Like, you know, while you and I believe maybe the Palestinian cause means better life for the Palestinian people, a state for the Palestinian people, this is not what the majority of Arabs or Muslims worldwide, or even people in the Middle East, including the Palestinians themselves, think of. When you tell them what the Palestinian cause means, they will not speak to you about a Palestinian state. They will not even mention it. They will say it is about destroying the Israeli state. It's not about building a Palestinian state. This is a Palestinian cause for them. So why this obsession with Israel and the Palestinian cause? It has to do with, like, quick flashes I will say them as quick flashes in the history of the region. First, in the 1920s up to the 1940s or 50s even, there was a conflict happening in this region that was called Palestine or Palestina at that time between the Arabs and the Jewish people who lived there. And what happened is that this conflict remained only there. It didn't leak to other countries in the Arab world, although it was very strong. I mean, it was very brutal. But it did not leak at that time, for example, in Egypt. The neighbor of that conflict, the direct neighbor of that conflict, movie stars, businessmen, the elite in the society were Jewish people. And nobody looked down at them or asked them to leave or anything.
This was under the king?
Under the king, in 1920s up to 50s. And then when Gamal Abdel Nasser came in the 1950s, he established the Pan-Arabism movement. Gamal Abdel Nasser was the first Egyptian to rule Egypt. Before that, Egypt was ruled, occupied actually by all types of people, the British, the French, the Ottomans, the Muhammad Ali dynasty. I mean, all types of people except the Egyptians. And for the first time, an Egyptian is taking over Egypt or ruling Egypt. And he, I mean, pushed by this egoistic momentum, you know, he wanted also to rule all Arabs and unify them under his rule. So he created this Pan-Arabism ideology. And if you know, Arabs are not the same. Actually, we're very, very different. If you bring someone from Morocco to speak with someone from Kuwait today, they will not understand each other. They need to speak a third language in order to be able to understand each other. So Arabs are not the same. And to unify them under one umbrella, you have to find a common enemy and tell them that this is your enemy and we have to come together to fight against. And from there came the idea of pointing at Israel as an enemy. And of course, Gamal Abdel Nasser, when he did this, he's coming from a communist background. This is his ideology. This is his political ideology, actually. And it was very popular at his time in the 1950s. So he to justify why we have to fight against Israel, he stigmatized Israel. And he was the first to do that with being an agent to Western imperialism, which we're hearing right now
the
everywhere.
Colonial,
you know?
White colonialists, right.
Yeah, it's an agent to white colonialists. It's an agent to Western imperialism. And thus, we have to get rid of this Western agent from the region. And this was Abdel Nasser's fight. This is what actually, what Pan-Arabism was based on. Hatred to Israel on this basis. And as you mentioned, like, this was the time when Syria and Egypt came together, formed one state called the United Arab Republic. It was very interesting time, but it didn't last for long. And all the dreams they had about, you know, crashing this tiny state or newborn state that's called Israel, of course, I mean, fell on a hard rock when Israel actually beaten all of them in 6 days, in the 6 Days War, 1967. And then eventually the Pan-Arabism movement had to die because they realized that, okay, we cannot, Israel is not going anywhere. We cannot get rid of Israel and we have to coexist with Israel. And then in the 1970s, we started to see rapprochement happening between Israel and some Arab countries like Egypt and Jordan and so, and eventually led to peace treaty between Egypt and Israel. And talks about peace treaty later that happened in the early 80s between Jordan and Israel. But actually, it's interesting also that at that time in 1979, something major happened, which is the Islamic Revolution in Iran. And inshallah, I mean, may this year be the end of the Islamic Revolution of Iran on the hands of Israel. Let's hope so. But this was the time when the Islamic Revolution in Iran was born, 1979. When this happened, with the death of the Pan-Arabism movement, and so this was the beginning of the birth of the Pan-Islamism movement. How this regime, this new regime in Iran, it's an Islamic regime. It took over a huge and powerful country like Iran, huge, powerful, and wealthy, and also very has a very strong cultural heritage. So it inspired other Islamist groups, including Sunni groups, inside Arab countries to do just the same.
Just to make clear for people, one of the reasons why the revolution in Iran led to pan-Islamism rather than pan-Arabism is because the Iranian people are not Arab, they're Persian.
Exactly.
So what connects the Iranian people, or at least the Iranian leadership, with the rest of many of the Middle East world is not the Arabism, it's the Islamism.
Great observation. Yeah. Exactly, exactly. So this inspired other Islamist groups like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, for example, to play a political role bigger than their local communities. Before, all the Islamist groups in the region, like Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia, Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and so, they would only work in their own communities, very limited to their own countries, communities, and so. And their goal was just not gaining political power, but supporting the existent political power. This was like their highest ambition. After the success of the Islamic Revolution in Iran and taking over power there, they said, okay, now it's our moment too. We are the new replacement for the communist regimes that kind of was weakened after the weakening of the Pan-Arabism ideology. So they started to be more active, and they came to the forefront, started to mobilize people, and they also wanted to have a common cause, like the Pan-Arabists. What is the easiest cause you can find? Let's fight against Israel. Uh-huh. Just building on that, building on the success of the Pan-Arabism movement, which is so ironic because you would think that the Islamist ideology and the communist ideology are different. They could be different in many ways, but actually when it comes to Israel, they are almost identical.
It's what we call here in the US the Red-Green Alliance.
Exactly.
Between the communists and the jihadists.
This was the purpose of the Red-Green Alliance in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Or kind of the green learned from the red and built on its success with the Pan-Arabism movement to create the Pan-Islamism movement. So this was the birth of the Pan-Islamism movement. This was the time in the 1980s when Muslim Brotherhood leaders came together and decided to create an organization inside Israel to fight against Israel, which later on was Hamas, Kata'ib al-Qassam, and then Hamas, as we know it today. And this was the time when the rhetoric started to change towards Israel from let's fight against Israel because it's an agent to Western imperialism, blah, 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 to let's fight against Israel because it's occupying our Muslim holy sites. And we have to liberate the Muslim holy sites, al-muqaddasat, you know this word, from the hands of the Jewish people. And thus, the rhetoric changed completely. That's why today you would find someone, for example, from Pakistan, from Southeast Asia, who's not even from the Middle East, who is very sympathetic with the Palestinian cause and full of hate towards Israel. And you would be surprised, like your country has never been in war with Israel. Why you hate Israel so much? Well, because he was learned to hate the Jewish people so much.
So this all brings us back to that moment a few days into the Arab Spring where the youth of the Muslim Brotherhood who come with all this pan-Islamist ideology that you are against and is maybe, you know, completely opposite to everything you believe in, but you have a common enemy. They are protecting you because they're well organized. Together, you're able to topple the government. Mubarak is gone. Who comes instead of Mubarak?
So after the fall of Mubarak, we got stuck. Actually, we didn't know what to do next. Yes, we learned how to bring down a dictator, but we have no idea how to build up a democracy. And it was so funny that when you go in the square and ask people, like, you know, why don't you run for office? You know, why don't you run for parliament, run for presidency or anything? They say, no, politics is filthy. We don't want to do politics. We are activists for good things, like bringing down dictators. But we are not going to be politicians like the politicians we once hated, you know? So this was the logic, unfortunately. So this created a gap. This gap let two groups compete over power. One of them was the military. The military is very, very strong in Egypt, very powerful. It has its own economic system. It has its own political system that nobody knows anything about it. Its own governance system. It's very autonomous. I mean, a lot of autonomy to the military that made it very, very strong over time. And it has also a very good source of income, which is the U.S. aid. An annual aid given to them in billions every year that they can use to build up the military and build their political strengths and their military strengths at the same time. So they, as powerful as they are, they thought, okay, now it's our moment to take over the country. Okay, but on the other side, people don't want anyone related to the Mubarak regime to come in, including the military, although they appreciate the fact that the military supported the revolution and so, but they did not support the revolution because they are liberal. They supported the revolution the same way the Muslim Brotherhood supported the revolution because they want to get rid of Mubarak, so they can take his place.
And also, just for people to remember the lineage, Mubarak was Sadat's vice president.
Yeah.
Sadat was Nasser's vice president.
Yeah.
And Nasser was, it was a military
man. He assumed power, actually. Nobody elected
through
him.
Through the military. So there was also that suspicion of the military because of the lineage.
Exactly.
So then, now
we ended up having the military and the Muslim Brotherhood competing over power. And eventually the Muslim Brotherhood won in this competition and they took over the country because people thought that they may be a good alternative. Like people who are speaking in the name of Allah, you know, in the name of God, they may not be corrupt. They may be really good people, but actually they were horrible.
Who was the leader?
Mohamed Morsi. But he was not the actual leader. Like he was only the puppet at the forefront, and behind him was the main leaders of the Muslim, like the real leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood movement, like Khairat Shatir and Muhammad Badia as a murshid or the super guide of the Ikhwan of the Muslim Brotherhood at that time. So they did horrible things in terms of, I tell you. First, they put in parliament, like now they are in the presidency, and to make sure the parliament will not go against them, they put the Salafists in the parliament. And the Salafists are even more extreme. In the first 4 months or so, when after the Salafists went to the parliament, they did not make or discuss laws, for example, about improving the economy or rebuilding the state or anything of that. They discussed this type of laws, how to allow girls to get married at 9 years old. Like they wanted to make a law to allow girls to get married at 9 years old. They wanted to make a law to make it legal, I mean, FGM, female genital mutilation, a horrible practice that is very common in Egypt, unfortunately, and was banned by the Mubarak regime a few years before the revolution. They wanted to make it legal, to make it allowed, just to, you know, cut pieces from the body of the girls. And the third thing was not to allow women to divorce themselves, which was also one of the good things that Suzanne Mubarak made a few years before the revolution, giving the woman the right to divorce herself before it was not allowed. They wanted to reverse that. So imagine, this is what they were discussing.
How did you feel as someone who was so active in organizing Arab Spring and seeing, you know, to take, you know, the often beaten use of a verse of the king is dead, long live the king. We have one dictator coming down, now we have a new dictator coming up.
Even horrible, now you are dealing with people who are claiming that they have authority from God. They are not just dictators. So it was very scary. And actually, but the good thing is that as scary as they were, this motivated me and the other liberal activists just to do the thing that we are good at, which is nonviolent activism against them. And within 1 year, we were able to remove them from power again. By mid-2013, the Muslim Brotherhood were gone. We made campaigns against them. We called for early elections. We pressured, we mobilized against them worldwide. I mean, we did great job. And we protested, also called people for protests in the street. And this time, actually, we were supported by the supporters of Mubarak, who were thinking that they are now taking revenge of the Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, it was very funny.
Including al-Sisi, who was the head of the military, right?
This was the military, yes. But the military actually did not intervene at the early stages of our movement against the Muslim Brotherhood. They waited and waited and waited until they made sure that it is already succeeding, and they jumped and or hijacked our work this exactly the same way the Muslim Brotherhood jumped and hijacked our work 2 years before. Mm. Exactly the same way. And they came in and they started to say, you know, we're here to support you. We will help you get rid of the Muslim Brotherhood faster. So we will intervene. We'll do this and that. And then they ended up doing the coup that we all have seen. But actually, I cannot even call it like purely a coup because it started from the people first. What the military did, they did not start the whole thing. They just hijacked the fruit of our work. This is exactly what happened. So we ended up having the military back in power. At the beginning, I was very excited. Oh, thank God we got rid of the Muslim Brotherhood. Yes, let the military come. And I believe them. I personally believed that they will come for only 1 year or 2 years to write a new constitution and make elections and bring in a civilian government. But here we are now, 10 years after. 10 years? Oh my God, 13 years after. Yeah. And the situation is still the same. And unfortunately, the military is controlling everything in the country right now, taking over everything and creating a dictatorship that is even worse than Mubarak's dictatorship.
So what does that mean for the average Egyptian? Now, Egypt is not only a hugely populated country, it's also geographically very big. It goes all the way from, you know, Cairo, the delta on the water.
From Mediterranean Sea.
All the way to the mountains.
Yes.
Where the Nile's, you know, it's like in bordering, if I'm not mistaken, Sudan and Ethiopia,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
But what is it like for the average Cairo, you know, middle class, upper middle class, educated woman like yourself living in Egypt right now?
Oh my God. It was not easy at all. It was not easy. It's, well, I don't even know how to describe it, but it's a state of schizophrenia. Like really Egyptians are living in a big, big state of schizophrenia, starting with, on the political level, I mean, on this political level, yes, there is very strong schizophrenia between what the politicians say and what they do. And the same thing on the people level as well. You will find, for example, how they dealt with the Gaza situation. They would sing love to the Gazans day and night, like, you know, and go on their keyboards and do everything you can imagine and say everything you can imagine about Israel and in support of Gaza and against Israel. But when the time came to open the border and receive the people from Gaza just to help them flee the war and come to a place safe, Egypt refused, you know. It's very weird and very hard to understand unless you see how Egyptians are thinking. Apply this to on smaller issues like, or not smaller, but more domestic issues like women's rights, for example. On some levels, they say, okay, we support women, you know, we are hiring this number of women ministers, we have this number of women in education and so. But if you see how women are treated in the marriage institution, how women are kind of enslaved, really, in this marriage system, and all the laws against her, how the
That's a very serious word, enslaved.
Enslaved.
So, and you mentioned that before we started recording because we talked about personal stuff as well.
Yeah.
What does that mean, enslaved? Oh, marriage?
Marriage, actually, first of all, you can, even in very well-off families, I mean, you can, and educated people, and so you can find it very acceptable that the husband beats his wife. And it's accepted by the society. It's okay, you know? And when the woman complains or refuses, then she's mistaken. Sexual harassment everywhere. And they blame the woman for it, not the man who's practicing sexual harassment. They blame the woman. Let me tell you, most families, for example, don't give the power of choosing the name of the children to the man, not the woman. The man can intervene, the husband can intervene in the way the woman looks, whether she goes to work or not to work, whether she continues her education or not. So once she's married, she's owned and she has no power over her life. So it's not easy. And actually, even on bigger scale, I mean, women's rights in general are terrible, and human rights situation in general is really, really terrible in Egypt. Yeah.
So before we get to more present time, I do want to ask, the Egyptian people, despite all odds, rose up against Mubarak, who was a dictator for over three decades, toppled him, then rose up again against Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood. And yet for el-Sisi, it's been 12 years since 2013.
Yeah.
Will we see the Egyptian people rise again?
I think it's difficult anytime soon because people, although, by the way, the economic situation is terrible. We are having an economic crisis right now that we did not have in our entire history, literally in our entire history. And I think, yes, people are exhausted, people are pressured, but I don't think they will go to the streets and protest because they don't know what the alternative will be. They are very exhausted already from the consequences of the 2011 revolution that actually the country is still paying for it until today, or still trying to survive until today. It had very, very strong consequences. I mean, when you bring down a whole regime and you have this competition between Islamists and the military, and now you have a military dictatorship, these are all things people are paying for because of the 2011 revolution. So the general mindset in Egypt now is that, okay, we don't want democracy, we just want security and stability. And also looking around us, like if you look at the map, like zoom out at the map and look all around Egypt, conflicts everywhere. So there is this big fear that if any instability happens inside, this may allow some of these conflicts to leak inside Egypt, into Egypt. So they don't want this to happen. So it will, unfortunately, this is, of course, giving more advantage to the military regime. And I don't think the people are still ready now to do something like this.
And I must say the parallels between what's happening in Syria and what happened in Egypt is quite striking, you know, because Arab Spring started, you know, in Libya, if I'm not mistaken,
Tunisia,
then Libya, Egypt, arrived to Syria, but Syria ignited a whole civil war that just recently ended, where the secular dictator was brought down and replaced by the, you know, pan-Islamist, who's now trying to save it. They're not pan-Islamist.
He's even worse. He's a jihadist. He's literally a terrorist. He's not, it's not, I mean, we're speaking about Ahmed al-Shara, of course, the new leader of Syria. He comes from a terrorist background. He grew up in the ranks of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, Daesh, you know. So we are speaking about kind of, we can call it actually political jihadism, if we can say, like political Islamism. Now we are in the era of political jihadism. And after what happened in Syria, it was so ironic that some of the radical Islamists in Egypt, also jihadists who already do exist, but they are calm, they tried to take over the country, actually. And they organized and they said, a guy called Ahmed Mansour or something like that, he was also a terrorist in Al-Qaeda. He mobilized and said, like, you know, we will take over the country from the military dictatorship and so. But thank God it was quickly controlled by Ahmed al-Shara himself. Because he doesn't want animosity with anyone in the region right now. Not because he's really a peaceful guy, I hardly believe this, but because he knows that if he showed animosity to anyone in the region, he will be quickly wiped out. And he doesn't want this to happen. He's very pragmatic, very smart, a smart jihadist, unfortunately. And he's very well supported by Turkey and President Erdogan, who's a pragmatic Islamist himself. So he's using the playbook of Erdogan really well. And until today,
is a pragmatic Islamist?
He's someone who, okay, this is a very good question. Because there is a difference between jihadists and pragmatic Islamists or political Islamists. Political Islamists, they are kind of, there is a spectrum of radical Islamism. At the very far left of the spectrum, there are official Islam or official Islamists. Institutions like Al-Azhar in Egypt, for example, it's an official institution. Its goal is to make people obedient to the regime or to control people by religion. Then, as you go farther towards the right, the Islamist groups on this spectrum are more on the grassroots side. They represent themselves as revolutionary groups, as the change groups, the people who are getting to get to rid the public or to get the... They are the groups introducing themselves as revolutionary groups who are here to support the grassroots citizens first and help them get rid of these official Islamists and the dictators who are controlling them. The first on this spectrum, as we go to the right, is the political Islamist groups like the Muslim Brotherhood. They represent themselves as a grassroots movement, revolutionary movement. They are here to support the people. You know, they have already provided people with, you know, money, blankets, medical help that the government could not offer at one moment. That's why also it was easy for them to run for elections in Egypt after the revolution, because they are familiar with these grassroots people. And then when you go farther, you will find the Salafists. Salafists are also radical Islamists, but they are more more extreme. Their ideology is more extreme. They adopt the same jihadist mentality and ideology, except that the difference between them and the Muslim Brotherhood is that the Muslim Brotherhood don't mind working within the ranks of the nation state until they destroy this nation state. They don't believe in the nation state, but this is the pragmatism part. But they don't mind working within its ranks. For example, the Muslim Brotherhood who came from the Middle East to the West, Western countries like the United States, for example, in the 1960s, 70s and after. They did not say, oh, from day one, we want to destroy America. We hate America. They do hate America. And they have even documents where they are writing this and saying that our goal is to sabotage America from within. But they don't say this in public. In public, you will find them running for Congress, running for mayors like here, you know, in New York, running for so and so. They are using the political system or putting themselves everywhere in the joints of the political system. So when the right time comes, they can just destroy this political system. So these political Islamists, Salafists are not like that. They are only focused on their extremist ideology and promoting their extremist version of Sharia, which is the Islamic law. And then you have on the very far right of the spectrum, jihadists, who are the core of all the terrorist organizations we know today, starting from ISIS, Al-Qaeda, even the group Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which Ahmad al-Shara belongs to. And so all these groups, all of them belong to this jihadist category. And the thing is that this jihadist ideology is mainly based on destroying the political system that the world knows today. And just remove republics, democracies, all of that. They want to remove all this political system altogether because it is a secular system. So all secular political system for them is not acceptable, and they want to replace it with an Islamic system. That's why they are fighting these wars or doing this terrorism. And now we are seeing a very interesting shift with the example of Ahmad al-Shara and Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is now they are not doing this anymore. They are playing the international game. They are playing the game of the secular political systems.
So they moved from the extreme right within Islamism of jihadists.
No, they didn't give up on their jihadist ideology. They are still, until today, Ahmad al-Shara did not say, I'm not a jihadist anymore. No, he's still adopting his jihadist ideology. He didn't come out and say, I'm not a jihadist anymore. He's only deceiving the public by, you know, trimming his beard and putting on a statesman suit, you know, and appearing like a president, like a secular president, but he is not. He wouldn't even shake hands with women until today. Why? Because he is a jihadist. And he's letting all his fellow jihadist groups wreak havoc in the country without control. Why? Because he agrees with what they are doing, even if he does not say this in public. But what he's doing is that he's willing, although his ideology completely rejects this secular political system where he is now, where he is doing now, like being a president of a republic, having a secular constitution.
Promising to have a constitution in Syria, yes.
Exactly. Like, you know, all or promising to have elections. And so these are secular practices that is very far from his jihadist ideology. But now he's willing to do it. Why? Because he's trying to play the role of the pragmatic jihadist.
I see. So we've kind of like zoomed out. Let's zoom back in. And I want to talk about the Egyptian relationship to Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
Because Gaza was, the area of Gaza was supposed to be in the partition plan, part of the Palestinian state. In 1948, the general Arab world refused the UN partition plan, and the Jews in Israel established a state of Israel. It was attacked from five different Arab countries, including Egypt, which ended the war with Egypt controlling Gaza.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."